Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, has been inundated with this election's constant back and forth and back about universal health care. But it got me thinking about medical thrillers. Don't you find it amazing that so many best-selling authors were first trained as doctors? From Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to Anton Chekhov, Somerset Maugham, and Michael Crichton, the list is extensive. Let's put the works of these medical maestros under the microscope as we turn to page one of the book report. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. Robin Cook, master of the medical thriller, is back with Death Benefit, his latest heart-pounding story of medical intrigue. The book report actually spoke with Robin on January 28th of this year, just before the title was released. Go to bookreportradio.com to hear the interview. Behind the prim gates of McMansions in Greenwich, Connecticut, Wall Street Wonder Boys turn their attentions from mortgages to another possible profit source, the $25 trillion life insurance industry. By securitizing the policies of the old and infirm, they hope to make another financial killing. At the same time, two exceptional medical residents are working closely with their facility's premier scientist on cutting-edge diabetes research. When their mentor dies suddenly, they launch a quiet investigation. And as they dig deeper, it becomes clear the scientist's death was not from natural causes. Is it possible someone is manipulating private life insurance information to allow investors to benefit from the deaths of others? George Guidel narrates.
Preck looked down at the bag and kicked it toward Artur. Preck glanced at Nikolai standing behind his boss and to his right. That's the second time he's looked at his watch, Preck said to himself. Artur stepped forward and went down on his haunches, his hands in front of him. Everyone knew the drill. They kept their hands down and in plain sight by their sides. Artur unzipped the bag and pulled out a brick of 100 euro notes and flicked through it with his thumb. Preck saw Nikolai glance at his watch again. He's waiting for someone, thought Preck. He looked at Ginty, who was watching Artur counting money. He's waiting for someone, and they're late. Now you have to trust me, said Preck. He was in a hurry. The money's all there, so I'll take the merchandise. Artur stood up and held up his hands. Okay, okay. His right arm still aloft, as if he was taking an oath, Artur reached into his right coat pocket with his left hand and pulled out a small object. Preck rocked forward and back on his heels. He'd had no time to react, but he knew Genty could shoot both Chechens in the head in a second. This wasn't a gun. It was a small aluminum vial, about 3 inches long and an inch around. Preck moved forward, took the vial, and put it in his pants pocket. Nikolai said something Preck didn't understand, and without another word, the Chechens turned and were gone, Artur clutching the bag with the money. Come on, Preck said in Albanian. When he reached the doorway, he turned left, the opposite direction to the way they'd come in and where the Chechens were now headed. The car's back there, Genty said, but Preck was running now, heading to a stairway on the far side of the building. They could hear loud voices echoing up from the other stairway and the sound of hobnailed boots on cement. This was who the Chechens were expecting, and it wasn't the Chamber of Commerce coming to thank the Albanians for their business. Fortunately, Russian timekeeping hadn't gotten any better since the fall of communism. Guns drawn, Preck and Genty raced down the stairs. Preck saw parked police cars and black vans ahead, doors hanging open. He turned and ran around the back of the building, Genty following close behind. The Chechens were in front of them, running toward a solitary car parked in the corner of a walled-in courtyard. Amateurs, Preck saw the opportunity. The Chechens jumped in the car, Artur throwing it into reverse and backing up and around so the car faced forward. Before Artur could get it into drive, Prek and Genty were on the car, firing into the windshield 3 times each. Artur was hit and thrown back into his seat, his foot pushing onto the accelerator so the engine raced to neutral. Prek and Genty pulled open the doors and dragged the Chechens out. Artur was dead, his head blown open. Nikolai had been shot twice in the neck, blood bubbling out of his airway as his life ebbed away. Prek slammed the car into drive and took off, looking for another road out of the complex. Prek's heart was threatening to break out of his ribcage, and he cursed loudly. He was sitting on glass, and he had to lean forward so his head didn't come into contact with whatever of Artur's gray matter was splattered on the headrest behind him. "What happened?" he yelled. "They sold us out," said Genty. "There." He pointed ahead to a track off the service road leading away from the apartment complex. He knew they wouldn't last 5 minutes on a highway in a car with no windshield before being spotted. "Hey," Genty said as Prek slowed down on the unpaved road. Prek looked over, and Genty turned his head to look in the back seat. Though streaked with blood, the Puma bag sat perfectly safe. Prek banged on the steering wheel and turned to Genty, and both men laughed, long and hard. Part 1. Chapter 1. Columbia University Medical Center, New York City, February 28, 2011, 7:23 a.m. The girl, 12, awakens with a start. She's lying on a thin mattress, on a low, narrow bed, and circling around her is a pack of girls. They're older, 16, 17, and as they shuffle along, they're staring down at her with obviously sinister intentions. Some are suppressing giggles, others are smiling, but these smiles aren't signs of happiness, they're smiles of anticipation. It's still nighttime. There are other cots in the long room, and the girl knows the other occupants are awake, but they won't move to help her because they know what's about to happen. Transfixed with terror, the girl is unable to react as the mob falls upon her. As she's being dragged off the bed, she sees her chief tormentor, the ringleader's face, twisted in a manic grimace. Still, she knows better than to scream for help.
That was Death Benefit by Robin Cook. Best-selling author Tess Gerritsen took a notable route to her writing career. While on maternity leave from her work as a physician, she began to write fiction. She published her first novel in 1987. Call After Midnight, a romantic thriller, was followed by 8 more romantic suspense novels. She also wrote a screenplay, Adrift, which aired in 1993 as a CBS Movie of the Week. Tess's first medical thriller, Harvest, was released in 1996. The book marked her debut on the New York Times bestseller list. Her books have now been published in 40 countries, with more than 25 million copies sold around the world. Her newest title, Last to Die, is the 10th in her extremely popular series, featuring homicide detective Jane Rizzoli and medical examiner Mara Iles. The books inspired the TNT Rizzoli and Iles series, starring Angie Harmon and Sasha Alexander. Now, retired from medicine, Tess writes full-time, keeping readers around the world turning those pages. Welcome, Tess. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy book tour to talk to the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
The Last to Die is your 10th Rizzoli and Iles novel. Are you already working on the 11th?
I'm doing the, preliminary thought work on it. I know what it's about, but I just haven't quite figured out how I'm going to go about writing this story.
One thing I really enjoyed, I was watching in one of your interviews, and you said you often don't know the ending of a book until you are midway through or even further on. Is that scary for you?
Oh, it's terrifying. I mean, it's like jumping off a cliff and not knowing where you're going to land. I've tried to plot stuff out ahead of time, and it never works. I always end up going off the rails anyway. So I think it's best for me just to be inspired by a situation at the beginning and just see where it takes me.
Yeah. Was this book, The Last to Die, tougher to write because so much of it revolved around children and violence?
In a sense, it was, but it also helped that the three principal children are really the they're detectives in this story. They are victims, yes, but they're also survivors. And I love to see these three children who are really misfits, who bond together throughout the course of the book, become victorious by the end.
You know, they really are interesting characters, so well written. When you're writing novels in a series like this one, how do you balance introducing your characters to new readers while keeping it fresh for your returning readers?
I think it's a bit like being introduced to somebody you've never met before. You're seeing them at this particular time, and you see what happens from this time on. You don't know what their past is. So I feel that readers can pick up a Rosalind Isles book anywhere in the series and just see where they are at that moment in time. If they want to find out how Jane met her husband, you know, how she had her baby, and how she and Maura first met, they will just have to go backwards in the stories.
Now, when you first heard that Angie Harmon and Sasha Alexander were going to play Rosalind Isles, what were your thoughts? Did you think the casting guys had it right?
Well, I think the big thing for me was that, you know, in the books, Jane Rosoli is quite ordinary looking. She's not a gorgeous woman. And when I heard that they cast Angie Harmon, I thought, whoa, now she's become beautiful. But I think the important thing is that Angie has the personality to match Jane's. I mean, it almost feels as if she was meant to play this role. They changed Maura Isles a little bit more. Now she's a lot more glamorous and a lot funnier and a lot, I guess, sunnier is the word. In the books, Maura is quite dark and almost a little bit disturbed. But I think that they chose the right chemistry to make this work on TV.
Have you ever wanted to write one of the TV episodes?
No, I'm so busy working on the books. They've asked me very graciously to join them in the writer's room, but I think I'm a little intimidated. And the other thing is, you know, TV writing is so demanding and it's so quick. They have to turn in a new script every 2 weeks. I don't know how they manage it. It must be totally frantic. I rather like the time, you know, I get to write a whole novel.
Well, I know that you are a physician. Do you have a personal theory why physicians also make great authors?
Well, the medical training has influenced the writing in that I know how to write about doctors. I know how to write about medicine. So when I get into Jane, into Maura Isles' head, I'm bringing my own experiences in because she's a doctor. I don't think that doctors are necessarily better writers. What we have is great material. We are exposed to people in crisis situations, and this is stuff that we can use in our stories. But scientific training almost saps the writing energy out of you. It makes you be very objective and scientific, and you're not playing on your emotions. To be a good writer, you need to really pay attention to your emotions.
And the details, which you always get so right. What branch of medicine did you practice? I mean, you weren't an ME.
No, I'm an internal medicine specialist, which means in adult medicine that's not surgical.
All right. And is Maura based on a colleague of yours, or is she a sort of a composite?
She is very much like me. I mean, her personality is like me, and we both believe in logic, science. We both went to the same medical school and undergraduate. We both majored in the same, anthropology as an undergraduate. So I use my own life as a shorthand for hers. The difference, of course, is that she's unhappily not partnered up with anybody, and she's an ME.
When you're sitting down to, you know, begin thinking of a new novel, how do you decide which sort of secondary characters to bring forward? Your cast of characters is always so rich.
You know, it really depends on the story. If a story requires a woman buried in a box, as it did in Body Double, I try and get into their heads. And sometimes the stories are launched on the character. I mean, it's the character who starts the story. And in the case of Last to Die, it was one of the female teenagers. It was Claire Ward who got the story started for me. So the richness of her character came first, and then the story followed her.
Are you also working on, quote, in your spare time, a different kind of a sort of a standalone novel?
I have ideas for it, but I think that they're going to have to be on the back burner because my next Rosalind Isles book is, I have to work on that first, and that's going to be number 11, and I think that the readers want that one.
Yeah. All right. You currently live in Maine. Do you ever bump into another famous maniac? By that I mean Mr. Stephen King.
Yes, I have met him. And in fact, I ran into his wife not that long ago. So I know them. You know, he and Tabitha are, you know, they're native mayors. They are really, you know, they just really belong there, and they're wonderful. They're down to earth, and not only is he talented, he is smart to a scary degree.
Yeah. He's a great friend of a good friend of mine, Dave Barry, who is also an amazing writer.
And I remember sitting next to having lunch with Stephen King, and he was having this long conversation with me, and in the middle of it, he sort of sat up and he said, "I just solved a plot problem." So while he was talking to me, his writing brain was still working.
And what is it about the Maine environment that you find is it quite conducive to your writing? Is it the long, dark winters, or I mean, you're from California, and how did you end up on the other coast?
Well, the long, dark winters is precisely what helps me. I would have a hard time working in California with the sun shining all the time. I find that when it gets dark and cold and you're stuck inside, you turn inwards. Your imagination just starts to go in overdrive, and that is when I love to write the most, is when I'm stuck inside and there's snow outside.
Oh, well, there's plenty of snow in Maine. So, Tess, The Last to Die, can you give us just a kind of an overview of the story of this one?
Last to Die is focused on three teenagers. Before the book starts, they are the sole survivors when their families are slaughtered. They were living in different cities. They don't know each other. And now it's 2 years later. They're living in different foster families, and their foster families are murdered. Once again, these three teenagers are the only ones who survive. So Jane Rosoli and Maura Iles must figure out what links these three kids, what they have in common, and really does it go back deep into the past.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, were you involved in the selection of the narrator for your audiobook, or do you ever sit in on that productions?
The publisher selects the narrator, and I believe that's Tanya Eby for the abridged version.
Yes, and she does a great job. Well, readers, I want to tell you that this is a wonderful page-turner. You should definitely pick it up. And Tess, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All righty, bye. And now, let's listen to a sampling of Last to Die, narrated by Tanya Eby.
The black car had vanished. It was now or never. She took a breath and sprang, felt the night air whoosh in her long hair as she soared through the darkness. She landed, graceful as a cat, and the branch shuddered under her weight. Piece of cake. She scrambled down to a lower branch and was about to jump off when that black SUV returned. Again it glided past, engine purring. She watched it until it vanished around the corner. Then she dropped down onto the wet grass. Glancing back at the house, she expected Bob to come storming out the front door, yelling at her, "Get back inside now, young lady!" But the porch light remained dark. Now the night could begin. She zipped up her hoodie and headed toward the town common, where the action was, if you could call it that. At this late hour, the street was quiet, most of the windows dark. It was a neighborhood of picture-perfect houses with gingerbread trim, a street populated by college professors and gluten-free vegan moms who all belonged to book groups. 10 square miles surrounded by reality, was how Bob affectionately described the town. But he and Barbara belonged here. Claire did not know where she belonged. She strode across the street, scattering dead leaves with her scuffed boots. A block ahead, a trio of teens, two boys and a girl, stood smoking cigarettes beneath the pool of light cast by a street lamp. "Hey," she called out to them. The taller boy waved. "Hey, Claire Bear. I heard you were grounded again." "For about 30 seconds. She took the lit cigarette he offered her, drew in a lungful of smoke, and exhaled with a happy sigh. "So, what's our plan tonight? What are we doing?"
"I hear there's a party over at the falls, but we need to find a ride."
"What about your sister? She could take us."
"Nah, Dad took her car keys. Let's just hang around here and see who else shows up."
The boy paused, frowning past Claire's shoulder.
"Uh-oh, look who just did."
She turned and groaned as a dark blue sob pulled up at the curb beside her. The passenger window rolled down and Barbara Buckley said, Claire, get in the car. I'm just hanging out with my friends. It's nearly midnight and tomorrow's a school day. It's not like I'm doing anything illegal.
From the driver's seat, Bob Buckley ordered, Get in the car now, young lady.
You're not my parents.
But we are responsible for you. It's our job to raise you right, and that's what we're trying to do. If you don't come home with us now, there'll be consequences.
Yeah, I'm so scared I'm shaking in my boots, she thought. She started to laugh, but suddenly noticed that Barbara was wearing a bathrobe, and Bob's hair was standing up on one side of his head. They'd been in such a hurry to chase after her that they hadn't even gotten dressed. They both looked older and wearier, a rumpled, middle-aged couple who'd been roused from bed and, because of her, would wake up exhausted tomorrow. Barbara gave a tired sigh. I know we're not your parents, Claire. I know you hate living with us, but we're trying to do our best. So please, get in the car. It's not safe for you out here. Claire shot an exasperated glance at her friends, then climbed into the Saab's back seat and swung the door shut. Okay, she said. Satisfied? Bob turned to look at her.
This isn't about us. It's about you. We swore to your parents that you'd always be looked after. If Isabel were alive, it would break her heart to see you now. Out of control, angry all the time. Claire, you were given a second chance, and that's a gift. Please, don't throw it away.
He sighed.
Now, buckle up, okay?
That was Last to Die by Tess Gerritsen. Kathy Reichs, best-selling author and producer of the Fox hit series Bones, is back in Bones Are Forever, a Temperance Brennan novel, book 15. Both longtime fans of the series and newcomers alike will enjoy this story of infanticide, murder, and corruption set in the high-stakes, high-danger world of diamond mining. Temperance Brennan, a forensic anthropologist, has been asked to examine the corpses of three dead babies in Montreal. It's a difficult assignment, complicated further by the fact that the infant's mother, a former and possibly current prostitute, is under suspicion. The investigation heads to a remote mining country where events take a sinister turn. Linda Eamon narrates.
It was 9 a.m., Monday, June 4th. I'd been awakened at 7 by a call from Pierre Lamanche, chief of the medico-legal section at the Laboratoire de Sciences Judiciaires et de Médecine Légale in Montreal. Lamanche had been roused by Jean-Claude Hubert, chief coroner of the province of Quebec. Hubert's wake-up had come from an SQ cop named Louis Bédard. According to Lamanche, Caporal Bédard had reported the following. At approximately 2:40 a.m., Sunday, June 3rd, a 27-year-old female named Amy Roberts presented at the Hôpital Honoré Mercier in Saint-Jean-Saint. The ER attending, Dr. Arash Kuchameshki, noted that Roberts seemed disoriented. Observing the presence of placental remnants, an enlargement of the uterus, he suspected she had recently given birth. When asked about pregnancy, labor, or an infant, Roberts was evasive. She carried no ID. Kuchameshki resolved to phone the local Sûreté du Québec post. At approximately 3:20 a.m., a five-car pileup on Autoroute 20 sent seven ambulances to the Hôpital Honoré Mercier ER department. By the time the blood cleared, Kuchameshki was too exhausted to remember the patient who might have delivered a baby. In any case, by then, the patient was gone. At approximately 2:15 p.m., refreshed by 4 hours of sleep, Kuchameshki remembered Amy Roberts and phoned the SQ. At approximately 5:10 p.m., Caporal Bédard visited the address Kuchameshki had obtained from Roberts' intake form. Getting no response to his knock, he left. At approximately 6:20 p.m., Kuchameshki discussed Amy Roberts with ER nurse Rose Buchanan, who, like the doctor, was working a 24-hour shift and had been present when Roberts arrived. Buchanan recalled that Roberts simply vanished without notifying staff. She also thought she remembered Roberts from a previous visit. At approximately 8 p.m., Kuchameshki did a record search and learned that Amy Roberts had come to the Hôpital Honoré Mercier ER 11 months earlier. The examining physician had noted in her chart the possibility of a recent delivery, but wrote nothing further. Fearing a newborn was at risk, and feeling guilty about failing to follow through promptly on his intention to phone the authorities, Kuchameshki again contacted the SQ. At approximately 11 p.m., Caporal Bedar returned to Robert's apartment. The windows were dark, and as before, no one came to the door. This time, Bedar took a walk around the exterior of the building. Upon checking a dumpster in back, he spotted a jumble of bloody towels. Bedar requested a warrant and called the coroner. When the warrant was issued Monday morning, Hubert called Lamanche. Anticipating the possibility of decomposed remains, Lamanche called me. So, on a beautiful June day, I stood in the bathroom of a seedy third-floor walk-up that hadn't seen a paintbrush since 1953. Behind me was a bedroom. A gouged and battered dresser occupied the south wall, one broken leg supported by an inverted frying pan. Its drawers were open and empty. A box spring and mattress sat on the floor, dingy linens surrounding them. A small closet held only hangers and old magazines. Beyond the bedroom, through folding double doors, the left one hanging at an angle from its track, was a living room furnished in Salvation Army chic. Moth-eaten sofa, cigarette-scarred coffee table, ancient TV on a wobbly metal stand, chrome and formica table and chairs. The room's sole hint of architectural charm came from a shallow bay window facing the street. Below its sill, a built-in tripartite wooden bench ran to the floor. A shotgun kitchen, entered from the living room, shared a wall with the bedroom. On peeking in earlier, I'd seen round-cornered appliances resembling those from my childhood.
We've just heard Bones Are Forever by Kathy Reichs. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. His name is Artie, a miracle of bioengineering that's about to transform the field of neurosurgery. Dr. Jesse Copeland knows him better than anyone else at the Eastern Mass Medical Center and knows it's too soon to be using the tiny robot on a living patient's brain. But Jesse's department chief is too busy to worry about ethics, and neither of them has any idea that Artie will attract a patient from their worst nightmares. In Michael Palmer's The Patient, Claude Meloche is a master assassin for whom murder is an art. Now Meloche has a deadly brain tumor, and he's dead set to have the best neurosurgeon in the world operate on it. To ensure Jesse's cooperation, Meloche devises a plan of intimidation that puts the lives of hundreds of innocent people at risk. Neurosurgery requires nerves of steel. But in coming up with a scheme to fulfill her oath as a doctor while thwarting a diabolical killer, Jessie will be performing the most complex surgery of her career on the knife edge of terror. Michael Kramer narrates.
Jessie placed two of the MRI films onto the fluorescent view boxes on the wall to her right. The dense tumor, almost certainly a rather large subfrontal meningioma, glowed obscenely amid the much darker normal brain tissue. The location was dangerous, and the shape of the tumor suggested that it was the type of meningioma that was poorly contained, with extensions infiltrating the brain tissue surrounding it. An Artie tumor, if ever there was one. The tumor is right here, Jesse said, pointing it out.
Yes, we know. Our doctor referred us to a brain surgeon, but he gave us no confidence that he could remove my husband's tumor without causing a good deal of damage. Our doctor then suggested we search for a surgeon in London or in the United States. We were in the process of doing that, and already had Dr. Gilbride's name on a very short list of candidates when he performed his miraculous operation on that young gymnast.
I see. Well, I'm sure Dr. Gilbride can help you, but you must know that surgery such as this is risky. Parts of the tumor are situated right alongside normal brain tissue. The dissection is extremely difficult. There may well be residual neurologic deficits.
We would prefer to speak with Dr. Gilbride about that.
Jesse felt overwhelming gratitude that the Count would not be her patient. Very well, she said. He should be back sometime tomorrow afternoon. You can come back then.
Excuse me, Dr. Copeland, but we have traveled a long way, and we have no intention of leaving this hospital. But my husband has had two seizures. If he has another, I want him here. We intend to pay in cash, so we will have no problem with your insurance or your health care system. I will be happy to leave enough money with your hospital administrator in advance to cover all the expenses of our stay, including my husband's surgery.
Mrs. Herman, I don't know if we can do this.
Then I suggest you speak to the director of your hospital. I will be happy to speak to him as well.
I guess I'd better do that. Jesse went down the hall to Alice Twitchell's temporary office and was rather easily able to reach Richard Marcus, the hospital president. A few minutes later, she was back in her office. Marcus had confirmed what she already knew. Running a hospital was all about money.
The president of the hospital will be happy to meet with you in his office. We have a private room available on Surgical 7, the neurosurgical floor.
Actually, we will need two. The Count's children plan to stay near him as long as he is in the hospital. I assure you, they will make it their business to be in nobody's way. We will pay whatever rate you charge.
Jesse knew better than to argue, and it was clear from the way the Count held his arms tightly folded across his chest that he had no intention of intervening again.
Countess, Jesse said, if Dr. Marcus says it's okay, and we have the room, you get the room.
And private nurses.
We have agencies that can provide you with that. The head nurse on Surgical 7 will know how it's done.
Anything else?
Yes. I wish to know when my husband's surgery will be performed.
Now that I absolutely cannot tell you. For one thing, that's Dr. Gilbride's decision. For another, our MRI-assisted neurosurgical suite is booked solid. It may be some time before your husband can be fitted into the schedule.
Countess Orlis Herman's smile was patronizing in the extreme.
We shall see about that, she said.
It was after 7 when Jesse caught up with Alex in the cafeteria. He and another security guard were sitting together. She was about to head back to the floor when he spotted her and waved her to join them. Wanting not to seem too eager, she grabbed a salad, some chips, and a decaf, and stopped to say a few words to a resident she barely knew. By the time she ambled over to Alex's table, the other guard had left.
I was going to call you to meet for dinner, he said, but some guy went berserk in the ER, and Eldon and I had to deal with him. Then Eldon insisted we take our dinner break together.
Why did he leave? Alex's grin reminded her of Clint Eastwood's.
I guess he left because I asked him to, he said.
Oh, Jesse managed, hoping she looked more composed at that moment than she was feeling.
That was The Patient by Michael Palmer. The Book Report could not resist this novel full of potions and elixirs, set in 1665. In Charlotte Betts, The Apothecary's Daughter, Susanna Leighton has grown up behind the counter of her father's apothecary shop in bustling Fleet Street. A skilled student, the scents of lavender, rosemary, licorice, and turpentine run in her blood. Her father recognizes her passion and grants her the freedom to pursue her considerable talents. Susanna is dealt a shocking blow when her widowed father remarries, and her new stepmother seems determined to remove her from the apothecary shop.
a proposal of marriage from the charming Henry Savage seems to offer Susanna an escape. But as plague sweeps through London, tragedy strikes, and dark secrets from her husband's past begin to unfold. It will take all of Susanna's courage to save herself from tragedy. Andover narrates.
Dr. Ambrose raised his eyebrows, and Susanna did her best not to look smug. "Perhaps you would like to warm yourself by the fire while I prepare the medicines for you," she said. "Do you know the correct proportions?" "I'm perfectly used to dispensing my father's prescriptions." She retired to the dispensary, a curtained-off alcove at the rear of the shop, and peeped through the gap in the curtains, while he, apparently thinking he was unobserved, lifted his cloak and warmed his backside by the fire. Stifling a laugh, she turned to the bench and set to work. As she bottled up the last prescription, the shop bell jingled. She pulled aside the curtain to see an elegantly dressed lady enter. "Please take a seat by the fire and I'll help you in just a moment," Susanna said. She handed the two bottles of medicine to Dr. Ambrose and, in the interests of repeat business, made the effort to be civil. "I hope you're warmer now." She wondered whether to tell him he had a sulphurous streak across his nose, but decided against it. "They say this bitter wind comes from Russia, which is why the frost has barely lifted since December." "Perhaps that's as well," the doctor said. "The cold moderates the severity of the plague. Except in the parish of St. Giles, of course. We must pray that the freeze destroys the pestilence." "Indeed. Put the prescriptions on my account." He nodded and left. Susanna, wondering if he'd been sucking lemons, watched him set off again down Fleet Street. What a shame his darkly handsome face wasn't matched by more pleasing manners. The other customer was a fair-haired woman of about Susanna's own age and dressed very finely in a fur-tipped cloak with a crimson skirt just visible beneath. She stood on tiptoe, examining the preserved crocodile which hung from one of the ceiling beams. Her small nose wrinkled with distaste.
"Is it real?"
"Certainly. It came from Africa. My father bought it from a sailor." Susanna still remembered her mixed fear and fascination when he'd brought it home many years before. She had tentatively touched its hard, scaly body with the tip of her finger, shuddering as it stared back at her with beady glass eyes. Her younger brother, Tom, had hidden behind the counter until their mother assured him the creature wasn't alive.
"This is Mr. Layton's apothecary shop at the sign of the Unicorn and the Dragon."
"As you see, the sign hangs over the door."
"Is Mr. Layton here?"
"Not at present. May I help you?" Pursing her lips, she looked Susanna up and down.
"I would like..."
She glanced around at the bottles and jars that lined the walls, frowning a little.
"Yes, a bottle of rose water will do very well."
"Tell me," she said, running her gloved finger along the counter.
"How many hearths do you have in this building?"
"Why, we have three bedchambers, the parlour and the dining room, and then there is the shop, dispensary and kitchen," stammered Susanna, taken aback.
"The house is narrow and crooked with age."
"But it is also deep." Susanna stood up very straight, a flare of temper bringing warmth to her face.
"And the parlour is panelled, and we have a good yard."
The woman sighed.
"I suppose it is well enough."
She put a handful of coins on the counter, picked up the rose water, and waited until Susanna snatched open the shop door for her. Relieved to be rid of the woman with her prying questions, Susanna stood shivering in the open doorway for a moment, glancing up the snowy street beyond the waiting sedan chair. She saw Ned, the apprentice, hurtling along towards the shop, returning from delivering a packet of liver pills to the Mrs. Lane. His head was down against the bitter wind, and she realized that he was on course to collide with the departing customer. "Ned, look out!" she called. At the last second, he swerved, narrowly avoiding barreling into the lady as she climbed into her sedan chair.
That was The Apothecary's Daughter by Charlotte Betts. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. Readers, a show on medical thrillers is not complete without a selection from Patricia Cornwell. We actually spoke to Patricia about her new title, Red Mist, earlier this year. Listen to the interview at bookreportradio.com, week of January 14th. During our talk, I learned about the existence of a body farm, an actual facility Patricia visited in doing research for her books. So I thought you'd enjoy listening to a sample of the body farm, Book 5 in the Scarpetta series, performed by C.J. Crit. Little Emily Steiner left a church meeting late one afternoon to stroll home. A week later, her nude body was discovered bound in orange duct tape. Called by the North Carolina authorities, forensic pathologist Kay Scarpetta recognizes similarities to the gruesome work of a serial killer who has long eluded the FBI. But as she tries to make sense of the evidence, she is left with questions that lead her to the body farm, a research facility in Tennessee where, with help of some grisly experiments, she might discover the answer. Scarpetta interprets the forensic hieroglyphics that eventually reveal a solution to the case, as staggering as it is horrifying. But the good doctor must also help her niece Lucy, who is embroiled in controversy at Quantico. And Scarpetta herself is vulnerable in this tale as she opens herself to the first physical and emotional bond she's felt in quite some time.
At 3:30 that afternoon, Emily left her house in Black Mountain, just east of Asheville, and began the 2-mile walk to the church. After the meeting, other children recalled seeing her leave alone as the sun slipped below the foothills at 6 p.m. She veered off the main road, guitar case in hand, and took a shortcut around a small lake. Investigators believed it was during this walk she encountered the man who hours later would steal her life. Perhaps she stopped to talk to him. Perhaps she was unaware of his presence in the gathering shadows as she hurried home. In Black Mountain, a western North Carolina town of 7,000 people, local police had worked very few homicides or sexual assaults of children. They had never worked a case that was both. They had never thought about Temple Brooks Galt of Albany, Georgia, though his face smiled from 10 most wanted lists posted across the land. Notorious criminals and their crimes had never been a concern in this picturesque part of the world known for Thomas Wolfe and Billy Graham. I didn't understand what would have drawn Galt there, or to a frail child named Emily, who was lonely for her father and a boy named Wren. But when Galt had gone on his murderous spree in Richmond 2 years before, his choices had seemed just as devoid of rationality. In fact, they still didn't make sense. Leaving my suite, I passed through sun-filled glass corridors as memories of Galt's bloody career in Richmond seemed to darken the morning. Once, he had been within my reach. I literally could have touched him for a flicker before he had fled through a window and was gone. I hadn't been armed on that occasion, and it wasn't my business to go around shooting people anyway. but I hadn't been able to shake the chill of doubt that had settled over my spirit back then. I hadn't stopped wondering what more I could have done. Wine has never known a good year at the Academy, and I regretted drinking several glasses of it in the boardroom the night before. My morning run along J. Edgar Hoover Road was worse than usual. Oh, God, I thought, I'm not going to make it. Marines were setting up camouflage canvas chairs and telescopes on roadsides overlooking ranges. I felt bold male eyes as I slowly jogged past, and knew the gold Department of Justice crest on my Navy T-shirt was duly noted. The soldiers probably assumed I was a female agent, or a visiting cop. And it disturbed me to imagine my niece running this same route. I wished Lucy had picked another place to intern. Clearly, I had influenced her life, and very little frightened me quite as much as that did. It had become my habit to worry about her during workouts when I was in agony and aware of growing old. HRT, the Bureau's hostage rescue team, was out on maneuvers, helicopter blades dully batting air. A pickup truck hauling shot-up doors roared past, followed by another caravan of soldiers. Turning around, I began the 1.5-mile stretch back to the Academy, which could have passed for a modern tan brick hotel, were it not for its rooftops of antennas and location out in the middle of a wooded nowhere. When at last I reached the guard booth, I veered around tire shredders and lifted my hand in a weary salute to the officer behind glass. Breathless and sweating, I was contemplating walking the rest of the way in when I sensed a car slowing at my rear. "You trying to commit suicide or something?" Captain Pete Marino said loudly across the armor-alled front seat of his silver Crown Victoria.
That was The Body Farm by Patricia Cornwell. In Iris Johansson's Close Your Eyes, music therapist Kendra Michaels cherishes the ordinary life she's achieved after stem cell surgery restored her sight. The skills she perfected during her sightless years, though, have made her a uniquely potent observer and problem solver. Now, a former FBI agent manipulates Kendra into solving a crime that could put her in mortal danger. Elizabeth Rogers narrates.
Kendra Michaels pulled the strap over her head and adjusted her guitar in front of her. "We're going to do something different today, Jimmy."
"No!"
She ignored the outburst. 12-year-old Jimmy Matthews hated any variation in his routine, but she was determined to coax him, ever so slightly, from his comfort zone. "Look at me, okay?" Jimmy looked up at her, his dark eyes glittering with defiance. He was autistic, and it had taken weeks for him to feel comfortable enough to make eye contact with her. She'd regarded that as a major victory. She knew there were other breakthroughs to come, if only she could unlock the secrets of that bewildering yet fascinating mind of his. She held his gaze. "Jimmy, remember when I had you put your hand on my guitar last week? When I told you to feel the music?" He nodded. "You liked that, didn't you?" He shrugged. "You could feel it, couldn't you? I saw you tapping your fingers and moving your feet." He thought for a moment. "I felt it all over." "I know. And I thought to myself, this guy has rhythm. You know what that means, don't you? It means you can feel the beat. You can feel it in your bones and in your soul." He looked away again. "I want to sing. I always sing." "And you're a really good singer, and you can keep singing, but I want you to do something else." She turned and walked across her small studio. It was a carpeted, octagonal-shaped room with a whiteboard, a piano, several colorful music-themed posters, and a large mirrored panel at the far end. "Come here. I want to show you something." Jimmy hesitated. She smiled luminously at him. "I promise that you're going to like this, honey. Don't you trust me?" He didn't answer, then nodded jerkily. "I trust you." Her heart melted. Another victory. "That means a lot to me, Jimmy." She gripped the corner of a white tarp and pulled it away to reveal a percussion kit. His eyes widened. "Drums! Do you like it?" He bit his lip. "Why should I like it? I don't know how to play drums." "Anybody can play drums. Whether they can play them well, that's another matter." She picked up a pair of drumsticks and placed them in Jimmy's hands, curling the fingers around them in a matched grip. She pulled him around to the other side of the drum set. "Now, sit down. This will be fun." Jimmy slowly sat, holding the drumsticks in front of him as if they were sticks of unstable dynamite. "You don't have to hold them so tightly. Loosen up. Feel the beat, like you did last time." He looked at the various surfaces around him. "But what do I do?" She strummed the guitar. "Whatever you feel like doing. Whatever sounds and feels good to you." She played George Harrison's "Got My Mind Set on You," accenting the song's strong and clean rhythms. Jimmy held the sticks over the snare drum. "Anytime." He struck the drum's surface tentatively. "Both sticks, Jimmy. Come on, it's fun." He used both sticks to accompany her on the snare, striking with a not entirely unrhythmic beat. "That's fantastic." He closed his eyes and nodded. He branched out to the tom-tom on his left, accenting his stylings with the lower-pitched drum. "Good." She pointed down to the pedal on the floor. "That's for the bass drum. Want to try it?" He pressed the pedal and reacted with a start as the kicker struck the drum surface. He stepped on it again and again, repeating the motion until he found the rhythm she had set. He continued on the bass drum as he struck the snare and tom-tom with increased vigor. Kendra studied him. Could it be? Ever so slightly, a faint smile was pulling at the corners of his mouth. Yes!
That was Close Your Eyes by Iris Johansson. Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers is an oddly compelling, often hilarious exploration of the strange lives of our bodies, post-mortem. Readers, even though reviews of this title were amazing, I have to admit, I thought twice about bringing it to you. But then I read this quote from Publishers Weekly, quote, "Uproariously funny, informative and respectful, irreverent and witty, impossible to put down." So here we go. For 2,000 years, cadavers, some willingly, some unwittingly, have been involved in science's boldest strides and weirdest undertakings. They've tested France's first guillotines, ridden the space shuttle, been crucified in a Parisian laboratory to test the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin, and helped solve the mystery of TWA Flight 800. For every new surgical procedure, from heart transplants to gender reassignment surgery, cadavers have been there alongside surgeons, making history in their quiet way. In this fascinating account, Mary Roach visits the good deeds of cadavers over the centuries. Shelley Fraser narrates the engrossing story of our bodies when we are no longer with them.
Many people will find this book disrespectful. There's nothing amusing about being dead, they will say. Ah, but there is. Being dead is absurd. It's the silliest situation you'll find yourself in. Your limbs are floppy and uncooperative. Your mouth hangs open. Being dead is unsightly and stinky and embarrassing, and there's not a damn thing to be done about it. This book is not about death as in dying. Death as in dying is sad and profound. There's nothing funny about losing someone you love or about being the person about to be lost. This book is about the already dead, the anonymous, behind-the-scenes dead. The cadavers I have seen were not depressing or heart-wrenching or repulsive. They seemed sweet and well-intentioned, sometimes sad, occasionally amusing. Some were beautiful, some monsters. Some wore sweatpants, and some were naked, some in pieces, others whole. All were strangers to me. I would not want to watch an experiment, no matter how interesting or important, that involved the remains of someone I knew and loved. There are a few who do. Ron Wade, who runs the anatomical gifts program at the University of Maryland at Baltimore, told me that some years back a woman whose husband had willed his body to the university asked if she could watch the dissection. Wade gently said no. I feel this way not because what I would be watching is disrespectful or wrong, but because I could not emotionally separate that cadaver from the person it recently was. One's own dead are more than cadavers. They are placeholders for the living. They are a focus, a receptacle for emotions that no longer have one. The dead of science are always strangers. Let me tell you about my first cadaver. I was 36, and it was 81. It was my mother's. I notice here that I used the possessive my mother's, as if to say the cadaver that belonged to my mother, not the cadaver that was my mother. My mom was never a cadaver. No person ever is. You are a person, and then you cease to be a person, and a cadaver takes your place. My mother was gone. The cadaver was her hull, or that was how it seemed to me. It was a warm September morning. The funeral home had told me and my brother Rip to show up there about an hour before the church service. We thought there were papers to fill out. The mortician ushered us into a large, dim, hushed room with heavy drapes and too much air conditioning. There was a coffin at one end, but this seemed normal enough for a mortuary. My brother and I stood there awkwardly. The mortician cleared his throat and looked toward the coffin. I suppose we should have recognized it, as we'd picked it out and paid for it the day before, but we didn't. Finally, the man walked over and gestured at it, bowing slightly, in the manner of a maitre d' showing diners to their table. There, just beyond his open palm, was our mother's face. I wasn't expecting it. We hadn't requested a viewing, and the memorial service was closed coffin. We got it anyway. They'd shampooed and waved her hair and made up her face. They'd done a great job, but I felt taken, as if we'd asked for the basic car wash and they'd gone ahead and detailed her. Hey, I wanted to say, we didn't order this. But of course, I said nothing. Death makes us helplessly polite. The mortician told us we had an hour with her and quietly retreated. Rip looked at me. An hour? What do you do with a dead person for an hour? Mom had been sick for a long time. We'd done our grieving and crying and saying goodbye. It was like being served a slice of pie you didn't want to eat. We felt it would be rude to leave after all the trouble they'd gone to. We walked up to the coffin for a closer look. I placed my palm on her forehead, partly as a gesture of tenderness, partly to see what a dead person felt like. Her skin was cold, the way metal is cold, or glass. A week ago at that time, Mom would have been reading the Valley News and doing the jumble. As far as I know, she'd done the jumble every morning for the past 45 years. Sometimes in the hospital, I'd get up on the bed with her and we'd work on it together. She was bedridden, and it was one of the last things she could still do and enjoy. I looked at Rip. Should we all do the jumble together one last time? Rip went out to the car to get the paper. We leaned on the coffin and read the clues aloud. That was when I cried. It was the small things that got to me that week, finding her bingo winnings when we cleaned out her dresser drawers, emptying the 14 individually wrapped pieces of chicken from her freezer, each one labeled chicken in her careful penmanship. And the jumble. Seeing her cadaver was strange, but it wasn't really sad. It wasn't her. What I found hardest to get used to this past year was not the bodies I saw, but the reactions of people who asked me to tell them about my book. People want to be excited for you when they hear you're writing a book. They want to have something nice to say. A book about dead bodies is a conversational curveball. It's all well and good to write an article about corpses, but a full-size book plants a red flag on your character. We knew Mary was quirky, but now we're wondering if she's, you know, okay.
That was Stiff by Mary Roach.
Readers, I hope you'll agree this week's show was a perfect prescription for those who love a good read. If medical thrillers are not your drug of choice, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for wonderfully diverse ideas. Thanks so much for listening, and please join us again for next week's edition of The Book Report.